the Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Hour, episode number 374. We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We pay tribute to the elders, past, present, and those that will earn that honour in the future. We are broadcasting from land that was stolen by the first white colonisers. It was never ceded. We also have the strong belief that we will never have climate justice until we have justice for our First Nations brothers and sisters. And then finally, we also believe strongly, we know that we have so much to learn from the ancient wisdom that's allowed them to thrive, often in harsh conditions, by the way they nurtured the land for millennia before it was stolen from them.
We did talk about how we can create a process for cooperation and finding common grounds. And the words were that if we walk to the middle, there is a solution. And today is the testament to that. Yes, when we walk towards the solution, we will find one. And I would like to congratulate the Cherry Point industry leaders, as well as all their employees, as well as all the union representatives. There are varied number of unions, and we heard from them prior to 2019, and then all coming together in one forum and working through that. And same goes for the environmental community leaders. I think that's the most unprecedented thing, that that when we received the first letter signed by environmental community and the industry together for the council to consider and approve these amendments. I think that's historic.
Yeah, so Paul, I agree. I mean, it was all about patience and trust and a willingness to listen to each other and hard work. And it all has come together tonight. Folks, you all that testified tonight, thank you so much for coming out and joining us in this historic meeting. I think it's a lesson to other jurisdictions all across this country that you can work together. You can do things that are great for your community, both economically, environmentally, and, you know, it's just win, 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 win. So, again, thank you all for your testimony. And council, are we ready to vote? I'm going to exercise my authority as chair and call for the roll to be called, please.
Kathy Kirshner?
Yes.
Red Brown?
Yes.
Todd Donovan?
Yes.
Ben Ellenboss?
Yes.
Maybe in a few years, we'll be talking about the Whatcom effect. What happened here in a little county in Washington State in America, Whatcom Council, could have huge implications for the rest of the world, including Geelong Council. Because what happened here was that you saw the community, the business, and the council come together and find out, yes, change has arrived. We are now going to put an end to burning and transporting fossil fuels. So they made a ban. We'll come back to this later in the hour, but I think this is maybe the biggest news in months and months, that a council has the power and that normal everyday people have the power to stop the fossil fuel industry right where it begins. Colin Market, what else is happening around the world?
Hello, Mick. Well, I have my global roundup in front of me, and it starts exactly where you have just put that quote. It is the Whatcom County, which is in Washington, and it's not such a small council as you might think. Whatcom County, it's on the northwest corner of Washington State. It's next to the Canadian border, and it hosts two of Washington's five oil refineries already. And what this council meeting has done is not just say that they're not going to have any more new oil refineries or fossil fuel utilities. They are going to stop those two refineries from any more action. Council Member Todd Donovan. He's the fellow who put it there, put the motion to the council. He said that he's quoted as saying the future is clearly renewable energy and we will not support fossil fuels. That's lovely. I'm going to leave it there because, as you say, we're going to be hearing much more about this. But I'm going to move just a little bit further north across the border into Canada, where an old friend of the program, our mining billionaire Gina Rinehart, has taken to the courts because her North American expansion has been curtailed, I think you can say. She's launched legal action to overturn the rejection of an $800 million coal mine she wanted to dig in Canada. The Rocky Mountains, in the Rocky Mountains itself, the Alberta Energy Regulator last month said, no, you can't build this coal mine here. And she is taking them. She has launched a legal action to overturn the EPA, if you like, in Canada. That's at her Hancock Prospecting Company. Further north again, Alaska and Siberia are both burning in unprecedented bushfires that are replicated around the Northern Hemisphere. One of the reasons that the Northern Hemisphere is pushing so hard on climate change prior to the Glasgow upcoming meeting is because it has these astonishing wildfires, droughts, and, well, all kinds of different, what we used to term acts of God elements, but basically they're now all slated home to climate change. Siberia has got 30,000 acres that are on fire at the moment, and more than 30,000 square miles have already burned in Russia, according to the Russian government statistics. Greenland's ice sheet has experienced what they describe as a massive melting event. And at the moment, Greenland's ice sheet is melting at 8 billion tons each day because Greenland's temperature at the moment is 10% above normal. Fires are still raging out of control in the Western US and Canada, and also in Brazil. And this week they were joined by central Turkey, where they're experiencing wildfires again. And just to finish it off, there are the mudslides in India and in central China. And in the wake of recent floods in China, which you might have seen pictures on the news of Hangzhou's underground metro, which was flooded when the floods came, that has rung alarm bells to just about every country that has an underground railway system. In the light of 2 weeks ago, when the United Nations pointed out that climate change was such that we could now expect a once in a millennium event to occur every 6 to 8 years. Now, if you've got a Paris metro or a Moscow metro or a London Underground or a New York tube system, you're looking to make sure that when a flood arrives, because it will do, it's not going to flood your people down in the metro system. It's something that we don't think of because we really haven't got one here, but it's something which is everywhere else in the world. And a final report from, again, from Australia. I found this really interesting. It's not really part of the global roundup, but from our sustainability point of view, there's a new study that was released this week that invasive species have cost the Australian economy $390 billion since the 1960s. But it is in order. It puts down the invasive species which have cost the economy the most. And immediately you think, oh, it's going to be rabbits. But it isn't. When you look at the list of invasive species which have cost Australia the most, the largest, first of all, the people who put out this report are the ARC, Centre of Excellence for Biodiversity and Heritage. And they found that feral cats is the most costly individual species in Australia. Over the course of the 60 years that they've been taking down these statistics, the feral cats have cost the Australian economy $13.5 billion, largely spent on population control. That's followed by rodents, pigs, and then come rabbits. But then above the rodents, pigs, and rabbits comes the weedy plants that were the most expensive class of pest overall, with ryegrass, parthenium, and ragwort costing more than $200 billion to control. So basically, the big problem that we've got in Australia is introduced species, and we introduced them. And the one that's costing us the most is our love of small, furry animals, cats. And we don't like putting them down, so we let them root loose, and they become feral. There, that's my roundup for the week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
Our first guest today is Philip Huggins. Philip is president of the National Council of Churches for Australia. And we had Philip on about 4 years ago, and we thought we'd get him back on to see how things are going for him. So, Philip, welcome to the Sustainable Hour.
Thanks a lot. Great to be with you.
What's up front on the sustainability front for you personally, or for the National Council of Churches of Australia?
Oh, we've been operating on a number of fronts, but my particular focus has been to try and make a good contribution to the UN Climate Change Conference 26, which starts in Glasgow on the 31st of October, all being well. And so I've been operating through our international networks, both multi-faith and the World Council of Churches, and, of course, also in Australia to try and ensure that between us all, the whole global family, we make the Paris Agreement stick and make sure that global temperatures don't keep rising above that target of nothing more than 1.5 pre-industrial levels. I've been focusing on advocacy in Australia with government to try and get a decent, what's called under the Paris Agreement, nationally determined contribution on the Australian side ahead of COP26, and working with colleagues and friends internationally in relation to the COP as well. So that's where my main focus has been. And we pray and we meditate and we do all the things you should do domestically, and the things you should do with your superannuation, the things you should do with your lifestyle and so on. And that's all taking off and growing. And I think we're all aware of that awareness and that endeavour of people to make their life as sustainable as possible. Anyway, it's good to be with you all again. That's a random summary.
Yes. Maybe if we can drill down a little bit on some of these things. Conversations with politicians. Is there anyone that stood out there as being displaying any sort of sanity on this front? Because publicly they certainly not.
Look, I went to as you might remember, I went to the last COP, which got transferred from South America to Madrid. And, you know, the whole theme of it there was a time for action. And unfortunately, there wasn't enough action, which says something about, you know, nation-state rivalries and all that kind of thing. But Australia was seen essentially as selfish and stupid in terms of our policies. And that was before the bushfires that followed a little bit after that. So I've been really, really distressed to try and get a better outcome out of our Australian political system. And we've done all the normal things you do. I recently gave a whole lot of dot points to people in marginal electorates and conservative electorates to go and have the conversation with their local member or the person who's standing in the next federal election. Just to evidence at the grassroots level what we know is the case, people's deep concern that the climate is changing, the consequences are going to be catastrophic, and we've got to take substantial action as soon as possible. In terms of the picture as it stands at the minute, as you're well aware, we have a federal government that is internally conflicted and can't even bring themselves to say unambiguously net zero by 2050. I mean, it's a it's a bleak context. Things can change quickly. We know that. But at this point, while many nations have made clear what their contribution will be, their nationally determined contribution to the Paris Agreement at COP26, ours hasn't yet been released. So we've just got to keep at it. And we've got upcoming conversations with Shadow Minister Bowen on the Labor side to see if we can get something clearer and more focused there. We've got continuing conversations with the government side and just trying to find that sweet spot where, you know, it's a civil conversation. We understand all our leaders have had, you know, dreadfully hard period of recent months of endless crisis management. We know the pressures caused by the pandemic and many other matters. So, you know, in a kindly manner, we're just trying to get that focus on some better outcome for the COP.
Mm. It seems like we had, like, day after day after day, we had a politician standing beside scientists for the pandemic and using the science continually. But we can't seem to be able to do that for the climate emergency, the climate crisis we're facing.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, really, because, you know, great people have written substantial kind of textbooks for Harris. Joe Biden said, when I think of climate, I think of jobs. I mean, we've had Tim Flannery, we've had Ross Garnett just really write the textbook for our Australian governments to bring about the combination of a sustainable planet and sustainable environment with economic prosperity and social cohesion. I mean, the work's been done. It just needs to be implemented. And that's why we've got to keep at it. As you know, at local government levels, state government levels, private sector, all of that, the shift is there. It just needs the national government to provide the integration.
But, Philip, isn't what's needed really deep down not just a shift in terms of that we get together around a plan, but there's something wrong with our values and the morals in society? I would like to point you to a little two-minute clip that was pasted on Facebook last week.
Greed is by definition wanting more than you need. Greed by definition is a cycle that is difficult to break, and greed can invisibly exist in all of us. I have everything I need. I have a wife who I get on with really well. I have two children who I adore. I don't have to do things for a living that I don't enjoy. Greed will never let me rest, but greed is a condition of our society. Greed is promoted and sold to us as ambition, continually wanting more. It's a statistic thrown at us, isn't it, that more people suffer from obesity than from scarcity of food. But greed is way beyond consuming food, but is connected strongly to consuming. And what is the abiding and invisible philosophy under which we all labor, toil, exist? Consumerism. To consume more than you need. Our economic system requires of us that we consume more than we need, that we buy more than we want, that we dispose of things rather than repairing them. So whilst individual greed is a difficult thing to deal with, it is an understandable social phenomenon. And the only way to be free from it is to develop a connection to the invisible world, by which I mean a spiritual life, where you feel satiated and connected to what do I want to say? Energies, consciousness, feelings that are not determined and controlled by external things. Like, if I am continually looking for approval outside of myself, I can never have enough approval. If I'm continually looking for stimulation outside of myself, I can never have enough stimulation. Freedom from greed only comes when you're willing to let go of expectations of being continually satisfied, when you acknowledge that the material world can only take you so far. But this will not be easy for you or easy for me, because we live in a world that continually promotes greed, because the world needs us greedy, so we continue to consume.
The world needs us greedy. The whole system is built on greed, says Russell Brand in a Facebook post that he put out. I think he makes a connection there to spirituality, and in that sense also to the church and to religion, which is significant. When we talk about freedom from air pollution, freedom from climate change.
So can I just make three comments in regards to that? First one, you can probably hear in the background, I'm in a playground down by the beach at Point Lonsdale. One thing I learned from Gandhi was you've got to look at the world through the eyes of children, and you make policy on the basis of what's good for children. And I've got grandchildren, so that's what drives me in this, to try and do what I can while I can to make a safe planet for them. The second thing is that, as that clip conveys, you know, consumerism is a life of empty vanity, and then it doesn't feed the soul, and yet it's a dominant culture. So taking account of that, what we've been doing in the NCCA is actually cultivating local conversations about how we do cultural change. You know the old saying that the culture eats strategy for breakfast. It's one thing to have a strategy to affect climate change, but if the culture won't let it happen, which is what we see really in this impasse with the federal government, we've got to change the culture. So we've been creating opportunities for people to talk about how do we make a more loving, more understanding and more forgiving culture. And it's really taking off because people can see exactly what the wisdom is of that last clip. So that's taking off. It's slow work. We'd like to be able to do things quicker. But I think my learning from the last period is actually you have to attend to the culture. The same's true at the UN, the culture of nation-state rivalries. You know, when I was at the last COP, one of the negotiators said it's like a big poker game. You hold on to your cards, hold on, try to guess what the next bloke's going to do, make sure you don't give more than you need to. I mean, that's not the system we need. So that's, you know, at a number of levels has to be cultural change. And the third little comment, which is really apt in terms of what you conveyed, just last week, two very different groups asked us to organise prayer and meditations for this period between now and the end of the year to really encourage people to be prayerful and meditating out of their various traditions. And that's really taking off because that's one contribution people with faith, even a little bit of faith, even uncertainty about faith, even a lot of questions about faith, can pause. And I pray the Jesus prayer, Jesus have mercy. And I pray it visually nowadays, just with images. Pray Jesus have mercy the same time as I look at images where I pray my prayer is beneficial. So I think those three comments, there's cultural change needed. That's slow work, but we need to do it. Prayer and meditation in support. And, keep on critiquing the way we're living. And look at the world through the eyes of the children.
Yes, and learn in a way how to do less and how to live with less and to be able to actually see the strength and the joy in that.
Exactly, and I think that's paradoxically been a benefit, unexpected effect of the pandemic, hasn't it? It slowed us all down, and lifestyles that we were kind of habituated to, thought we were doing the right thing, we paused and been able to think, well, that's all been crazy, I'm going to slow it down a bit. So there's been a, you know, it's a terrible pandemic, and I'm aware of shocking suffering that's being caused, particularly now by the Delta variant in nations in our region. But at least it has allowed us to pause and think about how we've been living.
Could there, Philip, be a side benefit of this for the churches? Because this is actually renewing the message that churches are coming with. If this became the core message,
the church is always between renewals, so there's an opportunity now. But it's only an opportunity so long as it's an opportunity to serve people.
Philip, last time you were on, we talked about the role of nonviolent direct action in getting the changes we need. Has your view towards that changed at all?
I'm not too sure. There's a range of things. Like I think when I patiently and lovingly relate to federal politicians about policies, I'm not all that happy with, in a way, I'm doing nonviolent action.
Yes, you are.
In terms of the effectiveness of what are often thought of as nonviolent actions, I think we saw at the last federal election how the visit to Queensland by Bob Brown and the actions that followed from that was used by the Murdoch media to actually cause the election result that we had. So one needs to be very smart about how one does these things in a media landscape, notwithstanding, leave aside the Murdoch empire, but a media landscape which by its nature is, when it's so competitive, which it is attracted to the story which is the most bizarre, the most conflicted, and the most visually violent. So you don't want to feed the beast by giving them stuff for the 6 o'clock news. They've got enough. Thankfully, the world is not as crazy and bad as the 6 o'clock news, but you wouldn't know so by looking at the news. So we've got to be careful how we do what's called nonviolent direct action. I can't, and be sure that the intention we're after is the intention we deliver, and we don't have unintended consequences.
Is that something you've considered yourself? Frustration from the other work that you're doing?
Yeah, but you don't know. It's dangerous to work out of your own frustration. So I keep myself in check.
Yes. Yep. Fine.
I think a spiritual lesson is to try and enter every occasion and every conversation afresh without negative perceptions of other people, even if you've got history with them that feeds those negative perceptions. For a new thing to happen, you have to keep entering each situation fresh and without carrying that past negativity, much as it might be realistic, etc. You've got to keep open that, you know, I'm a bit of a mystery to myself, everybody else is a bit of a mystery to me. And therefore, you've got to be open to the new thing that might emerge from somebody. People who transcend their own story and become inspirational leaders unexpectedly. So we've got to hope for that.
And isn't what Pope Francis has brought into this story a story of justice, justice for the poor? Because there's so much about climate change that actually hits people who had nothing to do with it. They did not make the pollution that is now causing the problem. You know, there's something about there that the rich people actually are polluting. The figures are, there are many different reports out about that the more you own and the more money you have, actually, the more you pollute the air. And in a way, it's like, do rich people actually have the right to pollute the air more than others now that we know that it actually leads to death of, in particular, people in poor countries?
Yeah, that's a lesson that we have coming to us and an insight we need to hear from our Pacific neighbours.
Yes.
They say very clearly to us in Australia, you know, we're drowning and the carbon economy is causing the sea levels to rise. We're anxious whenever it's a full moon night because of the tides. We've had to, as our islands have gone under more water, we've had to leave ancestors behind in there where they've been buried as the seas have risen. So for them, for Australia to offer a few visas for them to come and pick our fruit is not really what's needed if we're going to be good neighbours. Australia's doing good neighbourly things now in the Pacific in terms of provision of facilities after in the midst of the pandemic, vaccines and the like. But our good neighbourliness, for it to have symmetry, needs to have strong climate change policies taken to COP26.
Can anybody still deny that we are facing a dramatic emergency? That is why today I call on all leaders worldwide to declare a state of climate emergency in their countries until carbon neutrality is reached.
Our next guests, father and son combination, Les and Ryan Dew from Lara, and also we've got Charles Street, who's supporting them, who shares the concerns that they have. So we'll have a chat to all three of them about their concerns. So why are you coming on today? Ryan, first.
Well, you know, I've been living in Lara since about 2006, I think we moved here. As Lara's sign says, rural living at its best. We originally, my wife and I both grew up in Colac in the very, I guess, country atmosphere. And we just wanted some more opportunities for our family, our three young sons. And we moved down here and got employment. My wife's a nurse. I'm a motor mechanic. We're finding that our dream of rural living is slowly evaporating, and that large companies and Geelong's employment precinct along Hills Road is really starting to have a huge effect on Lara itself.
And specifically, what's the issue now?
The biggest one currently is a company called Prospect Hill International. They are currently in the planning stage of wanting to build a energy-to-waste plant. So it's burning, they're saying green waste at the moment, in a furnace to then generate electricity through a turbine.
Waste to energy.
Yes, so that's why. So it's trying to divert landfill waste that would usually go to landfill to then be burnt and generated electricity. I'm not definitely not an expert in this. I've sort of been doing a lot of research in the last sort of 2 weeks because of I was hoping that the powers that be that control this sort of stuff, the EPA, the Geelong Council, people in Parliament, would sort of see through what's being proposed by them. That is way too many holes in it. But it's seeming like it's just going to steamroll ahead, and then Lara and the surrounding district are going to be living with this monster for the next 25 years at least. The plant itself has a factory wall height of 40 metres. The exhaust stack that pumps out all the fumes and waste air or emissions is 80 metres tall, which that's taller than the lights at Gardenia Park. They're only 70 metres tall. So it's a it's a huge structure going in Lara. And then there's a hell of a lot more going on with that plant.
Okay, so let's talk about these in isolation, one by one. So the fumes, what are your concerns there?
These plants have been, the company Prospect Hill have employed another company called Jacobs to represent them and consolidate their planning information. And these plants have predominantly been operating in Europe and overseas for many years to help this, obviously, the modelling. Oh, they're their modelling, but they help overseas, obviously, with the problem with waste and landfill, which is a global problem. But there's been also the way these have been run. There's been a lot of disasters overseas when things go wrong, and also the... I'm not an expert. Maybe Charles is probably a better one to answer the questions in regarding to exactly what comes out the exhaust stack. Charles?
Yeah. My name is Charles Street, and my daughter and I are members of the Geelong Sustainability Group. We don't speak on behalf of the group, but we are members and take a strong interest. My daughter is a Lara resident, and she and her young family. So I'm sort of assisting her with this project. But we are very concerned about the construction of this energy from waste plant. It is a big incinerator. That's what it is. And the design throughput for this plant is 400,000 tonnes of rubbish per annum. There's two furnaces. The plant is duplicated. And so it's burning essentially red top bin rubbish and some commercial waste as well, in order to create steam, which then generates, turns a turbine and generates electricity. But the calculations that have been done by other members of the Geelong Sustainability Group suggest that the available feedstock for the plant is nowhere near, not within cooey of 400,000 tonnes per annum. There's nothing like that available. So, yeah, that makes it suspicious right from the start.
You say 400 tonnes of rubbish per year. So you divide
400,000. 400,000
tonnes of rubbish per year. Divide that by 365 days. Yep. That's 1,095 tonnes of rubbish per day they're planning on burning.
Yep.
And that's, as you said, a red bin or industrial waste. how do you sort 1,095 tonnes of rubbish a day with 40 employees? Yeah. To be say that what is being burnt isn't plastic, it isn't a pressure vac can of paint, it isn't a container of water. So if you put, say, a 10 or 20 litre container of water inside a boiling hot furnace, that's a bomb.
It is.
That's an explosion. Fluorescent tubes, globes, there's any number of things that put people just uneducated or just not caring, put into a red bin, it could go into inside this furnace. And then you've got the proximity of this plant. I'm not sure if you know Geelong well, but it's within 430 metres of the Viva LPG gas production facility. Have a look on the internet what a blebby is. When you explode LPG or LPG catches on fire, it's like an atomic bomb, especially when it's pressurised, and that's a huge gas storage facility. And then its other great neighbour is Sensi, who manufacture chemicals for agriculture. That's another high-risk facility. Another proximity, 350 metres from the closest family home, 1.2 kilometres from the closest residential estate, which is Grand Lakes, 2.3 kilometres from the Lara Lake Community Preschool, and 2.2 kilometres from the Lara Lake Primary School. So if that sorting facility, something doesn't gets burnt that isn't supposed to be burnt in that sort of furnace, that goes then gets exposed to the Lara community, which in the last 4 days, we've been exposed to a lithium battery fire that's happening in Lovely Banks, which is a giant Tesla battery station, which I don't think many people probably were aware was there. When a lithium battery catches on fire, fluoride gas is one of the toxic gases that is emitted from a lithium battery. And there's no real way of putting a lithium battery fire out. And we've been now exposed to that for 4 days.
Just to add to your concerns, if I may, I've read the documentation that was put in, submitted to the EPA, because the Prospect Hill International is the company that has applied for EPA licences to build this big incinerator on the outskirts of Lara there. So they submitted for two licences. One is a licence to construct and the other is the licence to operate. I've read that material, and as far as you're concerned, Ryan, about the incoming material and being able to sort it, the technical term for this is called receiving inspection, and we are very, very dissatisfied with the description of the receiving inspection that's in the application documents. For a start, I mean, there's nowhere near enough explanation, but like you, we just can't imagine how they could actually do it in practical terms. So the risk of prohibited materials actually getting into the furnace, the risk of things like explosions, we just don't see anything which allays our concerns in that respect.
You have a look at Shell or Viva, that factory, it has its own emergency response team, fire station, fully manned all day. And really, you would have thought this is almost under the same dangerous goods or dangerous industrial practice. Within one point, so close to family homes and young children. And another sort of part of the Jacobs report is that their traffic management report is to look into access to the Geelong port. So why would they include that if they weren't actually in the future looking at importing rubbish from outside of Australia? Then that's it. If you're trying to divert landfill rubbish to be into a furnace, well, there's still ash, fly ash and every byproduct of that process. Yeah, and still now going to add more just for the sake of burning more.
There's a few other weird things. Sorry, may I?
Go ahead.
A few other weird things about this proposal. Firstly, we believe that because the money to pay for, pay for the running of this, it's ultimately going to come from the rate payers and taxpayers. They're going to pay to have their rubbish burnt. Essentially, that's what it is. And because it involves public money in that way, we believe that there should be a proper business case for this proposal. The Department of Treasury and Finance are experts in the development of a business case, and we believe that the business case should be prepared in accordance with their procedures, and it should be made public. We should know what the business case is. Also, there should be what we call a pro forma contract. That is, the councils and the recyclers are the people who will actually be signing the checks, if you like, for this rubbish burning service. But they should be able to see a pro forma of a contract which says, this is how much we want to charge you for burning a ton of rubbish. And these are all the terms and conditions under which it operates. So there should be a pro forma contract. We've seen nothing like that. We've seen no business case. Also, there should be an environmental effects statement. There is a formal process for that too, and then we haven't seen that.
Yeah, well, part of the feed this site is 250 truck movements per day. Hmm. There's 250 trucks coming in and out of that industrial site of Lara. That's a lot of extra pollution in itself.
Hmm.
And noise pollution.
So this is where I would enter the Whatcom effect. In a small place, a county in America called Whatcom, the county council of Whatcom, they had an online meeting as we do nowadays in councils. At this meeting last week, they made a decision to amend the development plan for the industrial area, which is equivalent to that area you talk about out there at Lara with Viva and the other places there. And this plan bans any new construction that has anything to do with fossil fuels. It's the first time in the world that a council does something like that. But what I wanted to play for you is how the activists who made this happen, because there was a community that made this happen. It was not the industry. But they had a long, long process about how to make it happen. And it didn't happen in the end as a sort of them against us thing. It was actually the industry and the community together making this decision and encouraging councillors to vote for the decision. And it was a unanimous decision in council when it happened. To give you the inspiration from Whatcom, the Whatcom effect. This has consequences deep down in how we work in councils and what we as citizens can make happen. That we can actually say, well, in Whatcom, this is what they did, folks. So we can do this too. That is really powerful, how we deal with fossil fuels.
If there are any other speakers for this public hearing, please raise your hand virtually by clicking the hand icon or dialing *9 if you're joining by phone.
This is Dana Briggs, and I live in Bellingham. First, I'm going to say, solely based upon the comments made by the environmentalist side of the discussion and the public comments tonight, I'm urging the council to pass these amendments, but I'm doing it with the following caveat. For years, if not decades, every one of us has been told by the leading climate scientists on this planet that fossil fuels is killing us as a species along with every other species that actually exists. It's simply not a matter anymore of if this is going to happen, it's when it's going to happen. Some individuals mentioned the heat dome. We've got the wildfires raging. We've got the flooding that's occurring. We've got all kinds of other things. We've got the heat temperatures in Siberia going above 115 degrees. So this message to all of you, the council, those of you that work in the fossil fuel industry, and the environmentalists, is that we are out of time. We are totally out of time. Now this is only one step. And the next step that we need to do, and those of you in the fossil fuel industry need to start making plans to put yourself out of business and justly transition. I want you to justly transition. I want you to be able to keep your living wage jobs. I want you to be able to contribute to the local economy. I want you to do all of that. But you can no longer do it on the back of an industry that is killing every one of us. So even though we're going to more than likely pass these amendments tonight, and the council will do so, you need to start working tomorrow, not next week, not next month, not next year. You need to start working tomorrow to put yourselves out of business and get us all on sustainable energy so that we can clean up the biosphere to the greatest extent that we can and mitigate the damage that's going to come down the pike and that is already coming down the pike. Don't wait to do this, because even though it may not affect you directly right now, it's going to affect those children that you love and that are on those playgrounds and that you're donating money to for schools. It's going to affect any potential grandchildren and great-grandchildren that you have coming down the pike. And it's going to affect all your neighbors and all their relatives and all their friends, and most importantly, those that are living on the shores like the indigenous Lummi and others who are going to have communities wiped out because of sea level rise, among many other things. So please do not consider this the end of the process. This is only one step in a long, long process to heal ourselves and to heal the planet so that we can all survive, including humanity. Thank you.
Go ahead, please, and state your full name for the record. You have 3 minutes.
Good evening, Council. Alex Rammel, Climate Policy Advisor with Stand.Earth. I'm excited to be speaking in favor of this long-awaited ordinance. As a reminder, this process was precipitated by a series of fossil fuel transshipment, transport, and expansion project proposals that taken together would have more than doubled Washington State's carbon footprint. It would have risked spills and air quality impacts and harmed fishing and tribal treaty rights. This proposal says our community chooses a different future. And it says it with the courage and the conviction of an ordinance with binding regulations. The final product here has support, as you've heard, from labor groups, industry, as well as environmental organizations. And that is a testament to the integrity of all of the people who joined in the stakeholder group. And I really want to express gratitude for all the folks who committed time and energy to that important work. And it is also a testament to the tenacity of this county council. Your clear guidance, votes for moratoriums, and to advance this policy at each step of the process was a clear signal that change was coming and that it was essential to get the details and the definitions right. That mandate from you is what made the stakeholder group work. There's going to be more to do to protect our community and to protect our climate, but this is a model that can work in the future, both here in Whatcom County, and I hope in many other places as well. For tonight, I hope you'll all be proudly voting yes. Thanks for your time and your attention.
My name is Sandy Lawrence. I live north of town, and I would like to speak to the Cherry Cherry Point amendments in the context of the heat dome that we experienced at the end of last month. Seattle, as you know, got to 108 degrees and we had comparable temperature elevations in this county as well. I think this event begs several questions. The first is, was the event consequential? The second is, was there a climate signal in this event? And the third is, do the oil and gas industries bear a significant responsibility for what actually occurred? So first of all, was this important? Well, there will be no disagreement on this. Several hundred people died on the West Coast, including all the way up into British Columbia. A biologist in Vancouver went down to his local beach at low tide and realized that he was looking at climate change in the face. He saw many, many, almost countless numbers of shellfish that had boiled in the sun, and some of them had come open and had died, of course. Other researchers estimated that as many as a billion creatures died in this event, sea stars, oysters, and many other types as well. But another interesting group of organisms did not do that. Instead, bacteria, in some cases, did remarkably well. And one in particular is of interest to me. I understand that in this area, in this month of July, there have been 56 cases of Vibrio parahemolyticus reported so far, far above the usual number for this month. This is a disease that produces fever, headache, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea, which is often bloody. As a physician, now retired, I treated some cases in this county, but only two over the 16 or 17 years that I practiced in this county. The second question is this climate related? The best way to look at this is what's called fractional attribution, a subpart of climate science that had been developed in the last two decades. The World Weather Attribution Group decided after crunching some supercomputer time that the preliminary result would be a suggestion that this likelihood of being related to climate change was not two or three times greater, but actually more than 150 times more likely because of climate change to date. Finally, the relationship to Cherry Point. Globally, oil and gas industries release an inordinate amounts of CO2, not so much in their processing, but rather in the fuels that they produce. They also release 16 million tons of methane to the atmosphere every year. And the tar sands oil utilized by the two refineries here in Whatcom County actually release 70% more carbon dioxide than a conventional petroleum. So yes, this was an important event. There was a climate signal within it, and there was a strong relationship to what's going on at Cherry Point. Thanks.
Next is Matt Crowe. Go ahead, please.
Hey, good evening, Council. I'm Bellingham resident Matt Crowe with Stand at Earth, a locally based environmental organization. I'm here to thank the County Council and County Executive for taking action to pass these unprecedented and visionary policy amendments to the Cherry Point UGA regulations. It's kind of personal for me. In 1999, from my window at work, I witnessed the Olympic pipeline explosion right near my daughter's preschool. And this Christmas, I watched the plume of smoke from the Custer oil train disaster from my bedroom. The dangers of fossil fuels are real, both locally and for the climate. And these new ordinances, they will help protect us from so many of the threats that have come our way in the last decade. Coal terminals, gas pipelines, tar sands expansion, massive increases in vessel traffic, and more. The world is now moving in a new direction towards clean energy and low carbon economies. I really think this forward-thinking action by the council will help all of us in Whatcom County have a better chance for meaningful, clean economic development, along with that changing world, while also ensuring that the environment and our quality of life are protected. From former council member Weimer's work with the first emergency moratorium on fossil fuel permitting 5 years ago, the first of many moratoria, to today's council leadership, this process has involved thousands of members of the community who have worked for the best possible outcome. Thousands have turned out to campaign for local elections with these issues in mind, and yet more have turned out for public hearings along the way to finalizing these ordinances. By passing this ordinance tonight, you're also providing a template for so many other communities that need a pathway to break away from fossil fuels, from dependence on a pollution-based economy, and to have the freedom to choose their own destiny. So thank you to all of you on the council for passing these policies, and also to the thousands of people who have been there to support every step along the way.
Change is coming. So let's talk about that. And then getting the workers, as well as the businesses in the area, involved in this spirit of that change is coming.
It's kind of strange, actually. This process was tabled or submitted originally to the Geelong Council and then withdrawn. And then went to a state government level. So I think, don't quote me, but my understanding was that the Geelong Council didn't really want this to go through. And then they maybe saw roadblocks coming and then went above the Geelong Council.
Are you saying that it's been taken out of the hand of the city to decide what goes on in the city?
Yes, absolutely, yes. It's not up to the Geelong Council what happens on that, or this goes or doesn't go ahead.
So what now? What are you going to do?
I've started a Facebook group, Say No to Prospect Hill International Waste Energy Plant, which was trying to inform the Lara residents and surrounding area that this is happening. And then at the moment, they have till the 23rd of August to email or write a letter to the Minister of Planning permit number for that is PA2001035, and give your reasons why you object to this proposal going ahead. I'm not totally against burning waste, like burying it's not the answer. Shipping it to China is not the answer. Reducing our waste or going to zero waste is probably long-term the better effect, which some councils are starting to, I think my father's a bit of an expert or knows more about it, but there's councils in the Surf Coast Shire and the Colac Otway Shire looking to go to a fourth bin.
Surf Coast has already done it over the last, I believe, 16 months with amazing results of being able to lower landfill by 74% over the last 12 months, up by 20%. The fourth bin being collected, I think, every fortnight. Colac Otway Shire is following in their footsteps with a meeting last week, voting to go ahead with the same thing, plus a 9-year plan trying to educate people how to recycle. We have the government, as it is at the moment, all have agreed to a 10-year plan to try and recycle with a further $300 million funding backup to do so. This is the area where we do need to start to look at not having a EFW plant in Geelong, Lara, burning rubbish, which has been bought up. They can't get that amount of stock. They have admitted in their own submission in this planning application, they are saying within their own submission that they cannot get enough stock and are looking to bring what from the port of Geelong? The only thing that you could assume from the port of Geelong would be waste from overseas. I would hate to see our grandchildren left with a disastrous situation where Australia becomes a large tip. We also have a lot of groups all pushing sustainability, recycle. We've got to look at the bigger picture. We need some action. This has got to be, the objections have got to be in by the 23rd of August this month, which doesn't give a lot of time. People need to know what is going on. We also have the state government or governments in Victoria stating that they would like all parents who attend schools in the morning and afternoon to drop and pick up their children to please, or I believe, mandatory, turn your engines off. This is probably because we have a lot more diesel, four-wheel drive utes, UVs and everything else. So they are concerned about emissions and our children. We are now going to put a minimum of 250 trucks per day into this site. Trucks in Australia operate, the majority of them, I will confess, not all of them, at Euro-spec emission rules. Everything that has been quoted in the application, because it's modelling only, is Europe specification. Trucks in Europe are Euro 7 spec emissions. Just let's leave what's happening in the plant to one side. Let's just look at the impact of the traffic down the Princes Highway, Bacchus Marsh Road, Production Way, Rodwick Road, and the emissions from the vehicles delivering the stock. We've got to have a very good look at this. As Ryan stated earlier in the conversation, it almost needs a site as big again as its own fire station. There you can look at what's happened overseas and in Europe. Unbelievable accidents. It does happen. I'm not saying that it will happen, but it can happen. We have no fire infrastructure in provision here whatsoever. Next thing, we have no idea how the energy or the electricity from this plant, from the generator, is getting taken to the grid.
We don't even know the origin. Do they even want the electricity from this plant? Like, how many wind turbines sit idle because the grid can't handle any more input outside, like actual clean energy put back into the grid?
Can I just amplify one of Les's points about the feedstock and where it's going to come from? Something that's not really getting anywhere near enough mention is the fact that the EPA has already approved another big incinerator, and it's only 42 kilometres away from the one that's proposed in Lara. It's 42 kilometres closer to Melbourne. And it's only half as hungry because it's rated at 200,000 tonnes per annum instead of the Lara one, which is rated at 400,000 tonnes per annum. So what's going to happen? Yeah, that plant has been approved. It's got a licence, or works approval, it's called. So what's going to happen when that gets built, before the Lara plant gets built? It's going to suck up all the waste that would have gone to the Lara plant. So whilst, Prospect Hill International might be hoping and wishing and dreaming that they're going to get 400,000 tonnes per annum, possibly from Victoria, I don't think so, the amount of feedstock that they can actually expect is very, very much less than what they could imagine because of the presence of this other big incinerator that's already 42 kilometres closer to its market. That information's available, but there's not much mention about it. But, you know, economically, the Lara EFW, I'm really struggling to see how that could possibly be economically viable. This is why we need the business case. It makes it more plausible in my mind that there could be an ambition we haven't heard about to import waste from other places and burn that.
Bottom ash that comes out of these incinerators or these EFW plants are so much more toxic that do have to go to landfill. We've had authorities and state governments in New South Wales knocking back strongly EFW plants, one near Eastern Creek in New South Wales, and the reasons were health reasons, air pollution, and contamination of soil and groundwaters. How can one state get it right and another state get it so wrong?
And they've closed them down. They're moving to Australia because a lot of them have been closed down overseas.
Absolutely. Yes. We have an Arab company, MASDAR, have indicated that they are more than prepared to throw or pipeline $5 billion to EFW plants in Australia. What does that tell you? This is bigger than Ben-Hur.
This is coal. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
We are the land of droughts and flooding rains. We recognise that. It is a very volatile and often capricious climate.
At the heart of this conflict is a battle between truth and science and power and lies.
I think what we all could agree on, regardless of which religion we come from, we could all be saying destroying the earth and killing life on planet earth is against our religion. And yep. It really starts with that shift all the way down to how much waste we produce, each of us, because we can also make a choice when we're buying something. Do I want to buy this or do I want to buy that? I look at the packaging. Okay, I'll take this one that has no waste. So the decisions start in the everyday choices that we make, each of us. And that shift is happening globally, as we have heard today, different examples. And over the weeks when we make hour after hour of sustainable hours, we talk with people who are making the change. The shift is here. The change has arrived.
And as we are hearing today, The global is local and the local is global.
Correct.
It's all in this thing.
Exactly.
But all definitely all in this together.
Thanks. Thank you so much to our speakers today in the Sustainable Hour. And I think we will come together around this. We're going to make the change that we need to see. And certainly thanks because of you, because you are making the difference.
When it comes to burning waste, it doesn't have to happen. Be the difference.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Bye for now.
You're done. Thank you.
Be the difference. I know the world's gone mad. It's true. Be the difference.
Many people say that Sweden is just a small country and it doesn't matter what we do. But I've learned that you are never too small to make a difference. And if a few children can get headlines all over the world just by not going to school, then imagine what we could all do together if we really wanted to. Be the difference.